So, welcome everyone to our second week in our course on the design, construction, and addition to Villa Vuoto, my own house that we're seeing here. If you recall back last week, those of you that were here, we talked about proximics, this idea of the distancing between form and within space, and kind of what we outlined in that proximics was this approach that Rowena Reed takes, taught at Pratt Institute, my graduate school, really consciously focusing on these thresholds within space. Today's lecture is going to be in a different direction. We're going to be looking at my manifesto that it's circulating around. You can take a look at a written book that I wrote about the house. And that primarily was focusing on this idea of creativity, trying to figure out the essence of creativity. And in particular, finding that the creative process is a very subconscious process. And so today's class, we're going to get into this subconscious nature of design. In contrast to last week when it was a very conscious, deliberate kind of focusing on the feel of a space based on this proximic thresholds. So as I mentioned, the title of the book is called An Architect's Manifesto on the Origin of Creativity. I wrote the book in 2008, which was about 4 years after we had moved into the house, so I had a chance to kind of live with the house for a couple of years and kind of digest it and let it kind of sink into my subconscious a little bit before writing the book. But the book is a kind of an autobiographical collections of writings that, trying to get to the essence of this creative act. And using the house specifically as a tool to kind of really explore creativity and understand how creativity works. Also trying to, within myself, figure out my own creative process. And then also finally, probably most importantly, trying to figure out where's the source of this creativity coming from, which is, after years of kind of pondering this, I kind of believe it's a subconscious process. And so really kind of locating it within the subconscious is not an easy task. So I'm going to try to today try to lay that out and hopefully be successful at that. Before we kind of dive into that, I want to just make sure that everyone got a copy of the syllabus I brought for the course. And also, in addition to the manifesto that's here that's circulating, you can take a look at that. I'm also going to leave it after the class, the collection of books, so that way you can peruse it whenever you get a chance if you're interested. But also, we talked about a possible trip to the house at the end of the course. There's a sign-up sheet that's circulating around, and if you could just initial all the dates that work for you, because there's about a handful of dates, that way I can tabulate and see what date hits the most people. The idea is that we'd have to also set a time, but I'm thinking afternoon hours, so on those dates in the afternoon. One of the possibilities is that we actually do it on the date of the last class, which on the sign-up sheet is highlighted in yellow, and we just have the last class from the house. I thought would be kind of fun. Since the last class is going to be focusing on the addition to the house, we could kind of be right there and see it in person, which might be more meaningful. Of course, that's dependent on your schedules before and after the class, having the time, but we can work through that. So my house is in the North Hills. It's about a 30-minute car ride from CMU up 279. So transportation, obviously, you would have to work out. I mentioned earlier that I can come down and pick up a few people if need be, but I can't obviously transport everyone. So
I live up in Wexford, Franklin Park.
Wexford, Franklin Park, that's right.
But I have a class before this.
That's right.
I'm happy to take people, but I can't be there. It's going to take me.
Sure.
So if you made it
Yeah, so we can once we kind of get a sense of a date, we'll kind of work through a timing on that date, and we'll try to figure something out. So that evolving, and we'll get to that. So one of the other things I'm going to try to do today is the book that's circulating, I consider my manifesto, in addition, in combination with the house, is kind of my manifesto on architecture. The house is kind of like a physical manifest of that, and the book is kind of a written manifest. And so today I'm going to try to combine the house and the written together in this lecture, and really the two taken together is in my mind kind of the manifesto on architecture that I'm putting out there. And in particular, that idea is that architecture is an emotive medium, and it's subconsciously, again, manifests from these physical forms as well as these the flow of energy. And so we'll get a little bit more into that in detail here today, but that's primarily kind of at the end of the day what the way I kind of view architecture in general and in the house in particular. So start off with my earliest memory, which goes 50 plus years back, is from when I was about 4 years old, is furthest back I can recall, and it was this first day of preschool. And as you can imagine, like most memories, the more kind of like in the moment, the more impactful the moment is, then the more likely it's going to be retained by your memory. And so first day of preschool, first day of class, first day of kind of being away from mom all day is pretty impactful for a kid. And so it was retained to some degree, not super clear, but there were definitely some elements there. In that first day of preschool, one of the elements that retained was I recalled this merry-go-round, small little merry-go-round that was inside the building where we had our preschool, and this merry-go-round had different elements about it, and it was all, you know, just kind of thinking back now, 50 plus years out, trying to recall the details of that memory. It's a little fuzzy, but things like the fact that the merry-go-round is circular in form, the fact that the merry-go-round was very colorful in my memory, multicolorful, and in addition to that, the fact that it's, you know, merry-go-round's about play, you know, so it's very playful. And so these kind of three elements I kind of see as carrying through not only my work, but as you can see in the house here today, has a lot of those elements brought through, and it's this idea that at a young age, these memories, these experiences you have are very formative for your entire life. I mean, they kind of set in place what type of person you might become in a great way. And so I definitely see kind of like this playful approach and this these bold use of colors and circular form being the case in the work. And so in preparing for today's class, I have three sisters that I grew up with, and I kind of mined them to see what they remembered, because they also went to the same preschool, to see what they recalled from that, if they recalled the merry-go-round, or if that was something I just fictitiously kind of created from some other experience. And we were able to kind of dig, they didn't have any memory of the merry-go-round, but fortunately in the age of Facebook, they were able to kind of put out feelers for other people that went to this preschool, and I got confirmation that there was in fact a merry-go-round, and the preschool is no longer there. So this is, we're seeing here, this is Jeffrey Mansion. This is a private residence. It's turned into a public facility in the town that I grew up in, which is Bexley, Ohio. It's a suburb of Columbus. And the second floor in this room here was where we had our preschool. And so I got confirmation that there was in fact a merry-go-round. I'm in the process right now through the Historical Society trying to see if they can locate a photograph of it. This was all pre-internet age, so photograph would be a might be a tough find, but they're digging into it, so I'll keep you posted if we can find it, which will be interesting because then I can kind of take and compare my memories to what actually existed, and I can see where the differences lie. And we're going to get into this a little bit in the second half of today's lecture, but those differences, that conformation comparison, much like last week's class with proxemics with Rowena, where you put two images side by side and you would compare the two, it very easily articulates the significant elements as well as the insignificant elements. And we'll get into that. So Jeffrey Mansion was this place that had this, in the back, had this huge sprawling park, very kind of formal design setting, landscaping, really an amazing facility for that the community uses quite a bit. But what was fascinating for me as a kid, and for a lot of the kids here, is kind of like all these forts, and you can see kind of like the walls, and through these walls they had all these like little slots and kind of like little maze places that you could, as a kid, just kind of, you know, go out and explore and navigate. And you know, this experience is also kind of like seared into my memory, much like the merry-go-round. And that kind of, for me, defined the essence of what this place is, because, you know, on the many trips that we would be here, we'd find ourselves as kids running through and playing in these types of like mysterious kind of secret mazes. And it's also, to today's point, this sense of kind of like curiosity and wonder and mystery, all that kind of is set up by the way that the forms are created. The fact that you've got this small little narrow steps that lead down around a corner, you don't see what's coming. Like all these things are properties, the use and the design of the space to create this experience, this that you're having as a child. And it's that ability to take physical form and arrange it in such a way that you create this emotive response within yourself is really, I think, at the heart and core of architecture. So another memory that I had when I was a child was at playing at my grandmother's house with my three sisters. And one of the things that really stuck out at my grandmother's house was this orange vinyl chair. This is a photograph of the chair in my sister's house, who inherited the chair after I left my grandmother's house. The house that it at my sister's house here, the two of us would often, as little kids, we would play underneath the chair, and we would use it kind of as this kind of structure where we could play around. But in addition to that, the two of us, we liked to sing, and kind of like we had a tape recorder, and this was analog, of course. But we had a tape recorder that we would talk into, like silly talk between the two of us. But the chair provided this kind of like structure or shelter that gave us the confidence, as a shy kids typically are, to be able to perform and kind of like do this kind of silly, playful stuff that you do as a kid. Without the chair, you might be timid or shy and not kind of bring that out, you know, with the other people in the room. And so the chair in that way becomes very architectural. It becomes this structure, this shelter that provides the confidence for these young kids to kind of like explore and kind of be themselves. And so again, it's this idea that this physical structure kind of builds this kind of emotional confidence within the individual. And so it's this connection between the physical architectural element and the emotive response. Also, interestingly enough about the chair that I find interesting is that you would always find the kids kind of scurrying around underneath it, never sitting in the chair. In fact, it's always like, you know, parents like, you know, trying to keep them sitting in the chair. And it's always the adults that are sitting in the chair and never scurrying around underneath the chair. And so this chair becomes this kind of like transition between childhood and adulthood. And it's also interesting that, you know, adults feel more comfortable sitting up in a chair, elevated off the floor, as opposed to sitting down on the floor. And so it's this, here you have this element within kind of architecture that is transitioning from maybe before chairs existed, where you, when you wanted to sit down, you would just sit on the ground. This kind of grounding that you had to the ground, now this chair has kind of separated you from the ground. It's creating a distance from being grounded. And as we recall from last week with the proxemics, that distancing is significant. So kind of following along on those themes, looking at chairs, you might recall back from previous lectures, on the right-hand side is one of Antonio Gaudí's chairs from Casa Batlló. And this I put up here because of the, this is made of wood, oak, I believe. And he took the design of the physical form of the material, putting the seat with a belly in it, even the legs don't go straight to the ground. They have a little bit of a curvature to them. And so it's this kind of deformation of the form physically that creates a gesture to the chair. And the gesture is significant because by these kind of deformations, almost as if it was the chair was not made of this hard, rigid material like oak, but it's made of clay, for example, and you sit in the clay and the weight of your body kind of presses down on the seat of the chair, deforming it. It also buckles the legs a little bit by this, the weight of your body. And so he's taken this gesture in the material and he's been able to convey the sense of weight that the chair is carrying, but also kind of buckling under. In a similar way, Frank Gehry, with his chair here on the left from 1979 called Experimental Edges, is also deforming in a similar way to Gaudí's, but in a different way, where he's questioning the acceptability of the type of material. Gaudí was working with a hard wood, which was very common for making furniture. Here, Gary's working with cardboard, something you typically don't find as a material for furniture. And so here he's kind of like relaxing kind of like the tradition of what materials are acceptable for not only chairs, but also for architecture you'll find in Gary's work. And it's this way of kind of relaxing and easing or deforming this kind of tradition that is within the industry for design that he's doing through the use of his chair here. And so along those lines, I kind of see for myself this orange vinyl chair also has a similar aspect in this. And for me in particular, as we're talking about here today, and you'll see as we go along, I'm kind of recounting some of these memories that I had that were formative for me. And these memories change for me the experience of this space or any space that I kind of inhabit. Because when I come to a space, I'm also coming, bringing with me to that space all these memories that have formed me. And so my perception of the space is changed or filtered through these memories that I'm carrying, these memories that kind of make me up as an individual as opposed to another individual. And so by these memories, it's deforming the perceptions that I have of the space, much the same way that Gaudí and Gehry were deforming their chairs physically or architecturally. In my mind, it's also doing a similar way, but it's the architecture of the mind, the emotive aspect.
Is that the same chair?
That is the same chair. So we saw it here earlier. It was in my sister's house a few years back, maybe 1 or 2 years ago. It moved to my house, and so this is actually in my house here, which we'll see if you take the trip. And you can also see, to that point, you can see kind of like it's in a different setting. When the chair was in my grandmother's house, she had it tucked into a corner. And actually, it was a set of two chairs. One of the chairs is no longer with us. But she had carpeted floors. And so as kids kind of crawling around on the carpet, it was much softer on your knees than on a hardwood floor like my sister's house. So at my grandmother's house, and also tucked into a corner, much like the same way that the chair provided this kind of cover and shelter for the kids, also in the corner, also enabled that because it's kind of back away from out in the open. And so it kind of facilitated it. Whereas like my sister's house, not only did it a harder floor, but it's kind of out in the space, a little bit more exposed. So her kids growing up with the chair didn't kind of experience it and use it the same way that we used it as kids in my grandmother's house. In my house, it's kind of in between. It's not necessarily back in a corner. Well, the house doesn't have too many corners, but it's definitely kind of tucked back in amongst the plants and the bookcases and a few other things. But we also kind of acquired it after my kids had long grown up, so they didn't have a chance as younger kids to kind of play around underneath it. So if you crawl back last week, again, Rowena Reed, who taught at Pratt, this idea of proxemics. One of her techniques was this kind of pairing of images. So I put up this image here. This was a progress shot that I took during construction. This is my oldest son at the time. And I would go up onto the hillside and take a shot from this particular vantage point through the process of construction, just to kind of see the house evolve from that one vantage point. And as we're standing on the hillside and I'm taking this picture, he's kind of like, you know, making these gestures, moving around. As I saw this and noticed it, it was a gesture that was familiar to me, kind of like the putting the hands behind your back, standing there, kind of looking at the ground. At the time, I didn't recognize why it seemed familiar. Subsequently figured out later it was because it was a gesture that my father had. And so here's this gesture that's kind of carrying through from my father to me, to him. When I kind of noticed this and sensed kind of this familiarity to this gesture, I kind of backed up a little bit and got him in the frame of the picture just to kind of capture it. This kind of pairing of images where you can kind of see the movement and see it articulates the detail, you know, like how the fingers are different from here. He's gripping his wrist versus here it kind of shifts and he's gripped and his fingers are gripped and pinched together. Or looking at the ground as opposed to looking out at the house. It's this technique that Reed used as far as putting images together. We're going to do a little bit of that here today as we go through it. But more significantly for myself, it was this idea of continuation where you have this gesture that carries and continues through time, through people. Both genetically, in this case, but also learned. This idea of kind of like this balancing. There's a lot of gestures that you kind of learn and pick up from your environment. And so it's not so much critically whether it's genetic or learned. It's more, in my mind, the more significant point is the fact that it continues and it carries. And it's much like these memories that continue and carry through your life. And kind of resurface and reoccur is significant. And we'll get into that today as we go along. when we first moved back to Pittsburgh, or in 99, I was taking in an exhibit at the mattress factory on the north side. And this is an installation by an artist by the name of Yoshihiro Suda. His piece was called Weeds. These weeds here are, they look like weeds, kind of just growing here out of the cracks of the floor. But these were actually carved in wood and then painted to look like an actual living plant. And then placed specifically, as you can see here, this hole was pre-existing in the floor. Before the artist came in, but then in addition to that, some of the cracks here in the floor, he placed these pieces. And in the entire room, this was the extent of his installation, his work. And so that, to me, was really formative and really articulated something significant for me architecturally. And that was when I was coming through the museum and I was going from room to room to take in the different artworks. I arrived at this room, and as I was entering into the door, the room was empty. And so I thought, oh, you know, this just must not have anything in it. So I turned and walked on and went to the next room. I didn't even spend time in the room. And then years later, I was on the Mattress Factory's website looking around, looking some stuff up, and I came across this artist's work. And then I saw this in his work. I saw pictures, this picture here on their website. And I immediately remembered seeing that weed, because when I walked into this room, and it was literally just a second or two, I saw the room was empty. I went to turn, you know, to leave, and I noticed this weed kind of like, you know, growing in the cracks from the ground. And as I'm walking down the hall from one room to the next, like, the thought that's going through my head is, oh wow, because this was my first time to the Mattress Factory, and I thought, you know, what an amazing museum where you have weeds growing up through the ground, as opposed to the typical, like the Carnegie Museum, where it's like immaculately, you know, white walls and, you know, hermetically sealed. They would never have a weed growing up through the ground in the Carnegie Museum. And so, you know, I thought, you know, this is pretty nice. You know, like, it's relaxed, it's kind of like, you know, inviting. And so it gives like flexibility for an artist to kind of, you know, not have these limitations that you typically have in a museum. And so that thought was in my mind. And so years later, when I came across this and I realized, oh wait, there was an exhibit in this room. It was just this weed in the corner. And despite the fact it was a small little thing, it had this huge impression on me, to where it totally transformed my concept of not only space, but also, again, proximics, the scale. Like, you can have a piece that's literally this size, and you can make an impact on me, as, you know, as someone coming in to view the artwork, that sticks in my memory for years, and it retains, and it also influences my own work going forward. That it's not so much the scale and the size proportionally of the piece, it's how the piece is handled in other ways. You know, the fact that he is putting it within these places where you would expect the weed to grow makes it much more effective as a piece, as opposed to if it was sitting on a pedestal. This idea of these minimal gestures was significant. Also, the fact that it was immediate. It's a contact where I literally spent seconds in the room, but this piece was able to grab me within just seconds and put this thought in my head, to where years later, when I come across it, I'll recognize that weed because I remember seeing it. I remember the thought I had as I was exiting the room related to this. And so it was very powerful in that regard. Speaking of the Carnegie Museum, the International in 2008 had a piece also that was pretty impactful on me by this woman by the name of Chow Fei. She had a film that was her piece. It was a documentary called Whose Utopia? And this film was in, I think it was three parts. The first part was this series where she showed these Chinese factory workers that were making light bulbs, assembling light bulbs. And for me, what was interesting about this was this segment was only, I think it's like 10 or 15 minutes long on a loop. And as I was sitting there watching this piece, at the same time, there was a group of like grade school kids on a tour of the International, you know, by their school, walking through. And also, this piece was presented in a hallway, a stair hallway, if you recall the stairs that take you, the main stairs in the museum, that little kind of alcove where there's an entrance to the front on the main street that they have closed off. They were presenting this piece in that kind of little alcove there. So you could kind of actually sit on the stairs if you wanted, kind of almost like an amphitheater, and kind of watch the show. Or they also had a little bench out front. But as I was standing there watching the film, you know, these kids are shuffling by up the stairs, you know, of course, you know, grade school kids making all kinds of noise, ruckus, that kind of thing. And it struck me interestingly that here you have these people being documented making these light bulbs on the other side of the world, in great numbers of these people, China in particular being one of the countries with a huge population, you know, a billion plus people, making light bulbs for our consumption over here. And yet you have the American kind of culture, in this case, these young kids passing by completely oblivious to this documentary. They didn't take the time to watch it stop or any of that, so it had probably almost no impact on them. So this idea how you can have, much like his Suda's weed, very small thing here, you can have this very large thing and it have almost no registration or no kind of resonance.
Do you think they cited the film on the stairway to bring
up? I don't know, that's a good question. I might kind of like look into the curator that and see what was the idea behind that. That's an interesting question. Because again, for me, that's kind of what this piece symbolized, was this kind of disconnect between our cultures and kind of the way that one culture can kind of be completely invisible to another. And yet at the same time, still supporting that culture, you know, physically through these kind of manufacturing of light bulbs. And so, you know, as a curatorial way, I mean, it would be interesting kind of if that was intentional.
I was fortunate enough to have been a preparator for that exhibition and saw some of the discussion between Chaffee and the curator, and it was a mutual decision to make that space.
Awesome.
Chaffee felt that was going to be a lot of exposure there, a lot of people were going to be able to see the work and didn't mind the crowd.
Awesome. Oh, great. Glad. So there you go. Thanks, Aaron. By contrast, us Pittsburghers growing up with Mr. Rogers, Mr. Rogers in his show would frequently show these factory workers or these assembly line type workers going and showing how you make this, make that. I dug in a little bit, didn't get to have enough time to kind of really search his whole archive, but I couldn't find one related to light bulbs, which was, I thought would have been a nice tie-in. But interestingly enough, the message that Mr. Rogers, through his entire body of work, was always, there's only one person in the whole world that's like you, and people can like you exactly the way that you are. And so he's very much putting this message out, which is kind of antithesis to this, where it's the single individual, that every single individual has meaning and significance in their own individual way. And so it's this polarity between that and then these other individuals that could go completely unnoticed. And so what's the difference between the two of them? What makes a difference between an individual being noticed and an individual being completely unnoticed? And at the end of the day, it comes down again to this idea of proxemics, these thresholds that we were looking at last week. You know, there's a certain point in the things that we're handling, you know, the space that they screen the film, you know, back in an alcove with the lighting and this type of thing, you know, if maybe you bring it forward a little bit more to where you can't like scoot by up the stairs without kind of like it being in your space to where you take it in, as opposed to, you know, back a little bit more, recessed more. And these things are kind of subtle and nuanced, but they are significant and again, it goes back to the physical proxemics of space, form and distance that have that ability to transform something that could go unnoticed to something that could go unnoticed. If we go back and we look at like Suda's weed, if we look at it, he could have picked any of the four corners of the room to place the weed. And which corner he picked is significant because he probably studied the room very closely to see which one, if you were only gonna be in there for a second like I was, that will catch your eye as opposed to you might not catch your eye. And so it's this looking at these nuances and these details, really, in my mind, this is the work of an architect. This is what I particularly am trying to study and look at, is how do you manipulate these things on a very subtle level to hedge your bet or hedge your chances to try to make these meaningful impacts that you're trying to get resonate. Along those lines, one more example here. The Pennsylvania Turnpike, right where it crosses over the Allegheny River. A few years back, around the time that I was putting this manifesto together, they were working on construction for these retaining walls here. You can see, and they were putting down this new method, at least new to me, to where in the past these retaining walls had different designs and structurally and physically. In this case, they had this new kind of pressed mold that would create this look as almost like natural stone. And then they would colorize that as well, pouring concrete. And it was this idea of trying to replicate the natural stone that we have in southwestern PA, mostly sedimentary and kind of layered, as opposed to when they kind of put these roads and streets in place and they cut away the hillside to kind of, for the ease of the road, not having to go up and over hills, it could just kind of go plow straight through. In this case, as you can see, the height of it, the amount they were cutting in, they needed some form of physical structural retaining of that. So this wall here, they're trying to recreate the look of this stone. And as this was going up, and I drive by about weekly, it, you know, stuck in my head, you know, how kind of like odd of a thing this was, to the point where us as kind of like Americans that have the automobile such an integral part of our life, driving on these highway kind of like network of roads and highways around the country. Again, a lot of this is laid out for the ease of transportation, the ease of moving about, not having to go up and over these. Also, kind of there's a safety aspect to it. They're trying to make the roads as safe as possible in this transportation movement. And so in that, at the same time, in this case, the designer that worked on this decided they also wanted to add a little aesthetic element too, you know, kind of maintain the natural feel of this. And I find it, for me, it's interesting because it kind of enters into this area of nostalgia or sentimentality. And the fact that taking kind of like the stone and the stair behind this, and kind of bringing it forward and kind of replicating it in this new material, is in some way it's trying to preserve and hold on to that, but at the same time, much like Chow Fei's light bulbs, it's also kind of like hiding and obscuring it to where we're no longer seeing the stone, we're no longer thinking about the stone, because you can drive right by it literally in seconds and just kind of take it in.
What's the writing? Is it that graffiti on the bottom, right?
Right here?
Yeah.
No, it looks like cracks in the in the form.
No, it looks more written than that. No. I mean, shape. It's all cracks?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
So, also thinking about the nomads, kind of like the merchant trade routes through the Middle East, looking at historically kind of like the evolution of civilization, it always struck me that these merchants out on kind of like these open deserts, kind of this endless expanse of like the horizon and sand, would also, at the end of the day, after kind of like their movement, they'd set up camp each day, you know, for the night with tents, and the tents would kind of provide cover and shelter from this vast open sky. At the same time, they would kind of like wrap the rugs that they're sitting on that kind of also provide shelter from the sand ground, but up the sides, you know, to create kind of like this enclosed wall space to where they can kind of like take this endless expanse and they can bring it down to a human scale to where they go inside these tents for the evening. They can take this vastness that has an impact on the mind where you feel exposed, you feel vulnerable, and confine it. And so it's this idea of kind of insideness that architecture provides where we create a space that's at the human body scale as opposed to the much larger physical scale of the planet. So this is a photo of some of the stuff my oldest son made when he was a child. He would do this quite frequently. He would take mostly some of the strings and ropes and stuff and just make these huge kind of network of webs and ties, these tensiles, I would call them. And I always found it, as children, we'll always constantly ask why about everything. And it's this idea that children are constantly expanding out into their space. Like they're just oozing out and they're exploring in this way of trying to understand and learn and absorb from the environment around them, because they're young, they're still gathering all this information. And so much like these webs that literally would expand through the house and just kind of like with no limit, they do this kind of like questioning of why things are the way they are, because they're just trying to take all of this in. And as an architectural student, this was the question that was most often posed to us from our professors, was why? Why is your design this and not this? And we as students would have to have an answer for the why to explain, you know, our ideas behind the design that we're presenting.
What is the diameter of this?
This is one of these little tubes. It's just slightly smaller than what it is here on the screen. It's about 30 inches or so. But it was something to crawl through like a tunnel. Just thinking of this, the Jeffrey Mansion, you know, where we had these like stone steps that go around this little maze stuff. It's just this natural kind of curiosity of kids to want to have these things that they can kind of crawl through and play in. So in addition to the why question, another question I think is actually more significant is why not? My youngest son, this is his first painting that he did, and it's a small little painting, which is actually about this size, about 6 inches. He actually spent more time painting the back of the painting than the front of the painting. You can see like stretched canvas. This is actually the frame on the back of the painting. And you know, when you sit your kid down and you put paints and canvases and all this stuff in front of them and play around with them, kind of letting them go and just letting them explore it, not telling them, no, we have this kind of convention in society where we paint on this side of the canvas and like, you know, this side goes, you know, hangs on the wall. And so this question of why not? I mean, why not paint on the back side of a canvas, you know? And by exploring these why nots, sometimes you can kind of discover things that hadn't been done before or hadn't been explored before. And so it's this idea of, in my mind, trying to take that same type of vigor to architecture. Not necessarily intentionally rebelling against the conventions or the standards that are put out there, but at least questioning and asking about those standards and conventions as to why those conventions and standards exist and why they... how those standards, what do they offer? And so in some cases you'll find that when you ask the question why not, you'll find that there is a convention and a standard that has a significant reason that it's there and it actually provides a service or an advantage. But in some cases those reasons have been lost over time. And so they really have no value. And so those standards are an opportunity to kind of explore alternative variations. That's kind of where I see an opportunity within design to explore those variations. So with that, we'll take just a 5-minute break here. It's about quarter after. And we'll pick back up in the second half, and I'll get a little bit more into the actual design process. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. So glad to be in one of your classes.
Thanks.
Did you get a copy?
Does
this send it
too?
It does, yes.
I think it might be worth note at this lecture to mention that you ask your clients some of these same questions that you were asking yourself when you're designing their homes.
Yeah.
That you, like with all of your clients, you
right, right,
what was
right.
Your first memory.
Right, right.
I think that's very relevant
that's
to today.
Point. That's a good point.
And I think it also will get them to better tie into what you're trying to do today.
That's very good. Yeah, I'll make a point of that.
piece.
Yeah.
She doesn't know that much. But it's still, you're saying. Yeah, but then she gave me the feedback, and it was like, so they came up and handled it. Yeah, it was just, it was too.
Matt, was there a book?
There is, yeah.
I didn't get to see it.
Absolutely.
Was there a sign in sheet or something?
So this is,
I came in a few minutes later.
No, that's all right, that's all right. So, oh, thank you very much, perfect. We're going to try to have a tour of the house at the end of the course. And I'm trying to find a date that works the best for everyone. And this, the 17th is actually the date of the last class, so I thought maybe we have the last class from the house, possibly, if that works.
Have you done anything you want? I want to see that.
Yeah, yeah, excellent. So if you just want to, basically initial whatever, all the dates that work for you, and then we'll figure out a date that kind of hits the most people, potentially.
Okay. I'm going to Scotland. I'll be in Scotland from there on for 2 weeks, and then Ireland for 2 weeks.
Okay.
Fun. You want to go see Macintosh?
Nice. Oh, yeah. That'll be great.
Yep. Okay. Let the sound have a.
What's that?
Let you go out sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll do that.
Yeah, so, really would.
Are you? So, are you still working, or?
Yeah, I don't have 100 people anymore. I have 10.
Okay.
So I'm not in 3 states in 1. So I simplified my life. I call it semi-retired. I'm not retired.
Right, right.
I like what I do. Provide security to a lot of people. That's my thing.
Nice.
I could retire at any time, but I like taking the risk, especially if money, taking old structure.
Yeah.
Because I've always been environmentally friendly, green building contractor. I've always believed in that it came about.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of doctored myself towards its values and its ethics. So I take buildings from Pittsburgh, I buy them for nothing.
Yeah.
And I turn them around, but I make them solid structures.
Nice.
It's not just a flipper.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I probably lost money a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I just love it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's,
so what part of town are you usually in?
Right now, we're doing one in Mexmore Streets.
Okay.
And we just finished one in Mexmore Streets. And we're starting one in Coriopolis. It's an old marina.
Okay.
That's a piece of crap.
Yeah.
But it has some amazing potential. Was bought by the owner, but worked with before. The guy wanted $3 million for it. He bought it for $600,000. Well, it needs $2 million worth of work. So
yeah.
He asked me to do it. I said, part time. I don't want to do that.
Right, right.
I want to do this. I want to meet people of like yourself.
Right, right.
I've been alone for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so we'll definitely connect. I'd be curious to see some of your projects. Why?
I'll bring one in.
All right.
8,000 square foot building, warehouse. We turned into took out the center, made a deck on top, and that was actually Open Hill District. And, made it a family.
Nice.
That was pretty interesting.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
Such
Matthew, next to the Mattress Factory, what's the thing they have, you know, for writers and artists that come in residence?
The Asylum.
Really?
City of Asylum.
That's
why I actually So we can get back into it. This picture here is the speaking of memories, this is the first image that I saw of Gaudi's work as a student in undergraduate school. And learned of his work through this image, the class, and the thing that's interesting about this image, and back again to my memory of this image and this moment in my history class, learning of Gaudi, is that I can remember the feeling that I had at the time I saw this in comparison to some of the other architectural historical works that we were studying in that class, and the impression that it made on me. I was mesmerized by it, and remember almost nothing that my teacher was saying about it. Again, it's this, and the mesmerizing that was happening is in direct response to the form, this piece, and. In particular, if we look at kind of how this form happened, this is a sectional drawing through it, and it's a study of the structural forces and loads that the space is trying to manage. The viaduct here that it's referred to is built into a hillside. The hillside up here on the left-hand side is coming down. And then there's this large expanse of open space here on the right-hand side that this colonnade here opens up to. You see the light kind of flooding in from the right. But this managing the kind of like the load of the weight of this hillside coming down to this open space on the right. And so there's this method at the time that was used in the 1800s referred to as graphic statics. And they would take and they would do these kind of drawings where you can see the angle of the hillside here on the left-hand side, and all of these arrows are related to these forces where it's coming down, it's being applied, and then he's taken this profile here, which is a very common kind of Gaudi profile, this parabolic shape, and that distributes the weight at the top here and kind of the loads coming down. And taking in particular significant this column here on the right hand side is angled as opposed to upright that you're seeing here, this smaller one here that holds and supports kind of like the edge of the top of the lane, but this angling that's turning in direction to the load that's also angling down from the hillside, so that way this by angling it actually becomes physically more stable as an element as opposed to an upright column. And so seeing this as a young student, this was one of, from memory, I think might be one of the first kind of angled columns that I recall seeing. Then seeing that there was a reason behind this angling, much the same way that the wall on the right left-hand side also has that same angling. One of the other things that I kind of found the really enjoy is the bench, continuous bench here that runs along the bottom. So not only has this become a colonnade that you can walk in circulation, but it's a place that you can sit down and also take a rest. But I like the fact that if you think back to the Casa Batlló chair that we looked at earlier, here he's taking kind of the loading of this hillside and almost as if this bench is made in clay again, like his wood chair, to where it's almost kind of buckling. It's almost like the bench was not here, but the wall of stone is coming down and the load is kind of buckling and creating this like little compression and overflow at the bottom that happens to just be at the right height to sit on. And so that to me, the little detail like that is fascinating. So kind of taking that same gesture that we're having in Gaudi's viaduct, you see the same way that a wave kind of breaks, you see the same type of flow that you see in the viaduct, similar to a gymnast on a beam, kind of doing a backflip, has the same type of gesture, and it's more than just the gesture that Gaudi's doing with his viaduct, or that this wave is doing, or this gymnast is doing, but it's actually the elements within that gesture are also the same. You can take, for example, in this case, you can the material, the weight, the water that's making up this wave, as well as the energy in that water, the movement of that water, as this wave is coming across the beach or the ocean here, this water is being pulled and swept up this way. It's creating this kind of vortex that turns and then wraps, and then the overflow is coming down over on top here. And so you have, looking the same way that this gymnast is moving down this beam backwards, doing this backflip, the movement, just like the wave is coming from left to right, much like Gaudi's viaduct, the weight's coming down the hillside left to right. But in this case, this entire body at this point, actually about a half second earlier, the entire body weight is being placed on this arm. Again, this is kind of where Gaudi's little bench is happening in his viaduct. And so you have the arms of the body here is performing the same task that the wave is doing here, as well as Gaudi's viaduct. And you also have this point up here where the back is bending. You're having this kind of tensile strength that's happening, where this weight of the body is being distributed, transferred from the arms to the legs, to where the backflip continues, then all the weight will be taken on the legs, and then the arms will come back up over. And so this point in the form is representing this transition from transferring the weight from this point to this point. And then again, finally, the legs down here, a moment earlier before they make contact, they're creating this point where there's weight on the leg, but none of that weight is being transferred to the ground. And so it's this point right before it transfers, this disconnect, this distancing separation that creates a very strong tension, visual tension, because it's a point of focus that draws your eye in. Much the same way the breaking wave here is pulling over the top before that wave crashes down onto the water. It has this visual element to where you see a photograph like this. Your eye is naturally kind of drawn to that point. And so you have these kind of three basic elements that this creates within the structure. You have first the nature of this curvature. If we go back to Gaudi's viaduct, the nature of this space, this curvature, creates this interior space here that becomes highly charged or activated. If you recall back from last week's lecture with Reed's proxemics, you're creating this interior space that becomes activated by the form. And it becomes clearly delineated from this space that's out here in the open, or this space in here that's completely covered.
I assume a huge Gaudi fan, but I don't see the bench.
No, you're very observant, so you passed. That was the first test. This colonnade goes down here to the corner, and then it turns the corner and it goes down this way. The bench is only on one side, it's not throughout.
Okay.
So, very good, very observant. You could be an architect.
His work, they finally finished the Familia Sagrada, right?
No, still working on it. They're shooting, and the original plan was 2026 on the anniversary, 100-year anniversary, and but COVID kind of threw a wrench in that. I think they're still going to make it, but they're kind of pushing to make that happen. So if you're in Barcelona in 2026, it's going to be a pretty big party that they have planned for that event.
So to probe a little bit, do you care that it's form and there's a function too?
Man, great segue, perfect. The function aspect, and also traditionally, if you ask someone what's the difference between art and architecture, they'll say function kind of defines the gap. And there's an ongoing argument that we are having, or that I make, that know architecture is not simply just function, and it's in the realm of art. And maybe, you know, and that's also not to say that art is functionalist. But yes, I mean, so what makes Gaudi, in my mind, you know, at the top of the list is that he takes all of this on. He takes on, you know, he solves the function of this space. It functions well. On a rainy day, you can get from this point to that point without getting wet. He also handles structurally, which is also another task for an architect, is to make the space hold up, you know, structurally. Durable, you know, it holds up to the elements over time. But in addition to that, you know, that's not enough. He also is bringing these other things to it that we're talking about here, where the form becomes emotive. It has this impact on you, where you're having this transfer from physical to emotional, and it's this transfer that I think is, in my mind, is at the heart of architecture. It's not something that's exclusive to art. Yes, function's important and function's part of it, but it's just a part. That answer?
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to kind of creating this form, this particular form, creating this kind of insideness, sense of insideness, it's also creating a threshold, kind of the threshold of space. In this case, it's kind of defined by this. Once you kind of step between these columns, and much like last week when I was walking through the door, you know, when you get between these columns, there's a definite change of sense of space here than there is from here, and from there is from over here. And so that's threshold that you're kind of passing. There's this point, and it, much like in the first half of the lecture, us talking about how, you know, how is it that in some cases you can have a billion people go unnoticed, and in other cases you can have a single individual be noticed. It's that threshold. There's some place in between there. You make this transition from one to the other, and so something becomes significant or insignificant between the two. And then finally, the last element here is kind of like this focal point, this point of where the eye is kind of drawn, or all of this energy that's wrapped up in this wave is all being placed right here at the end. That's where your eye is kind of drawn to. But more than your eye, it's also, if you're in this space, you just naturally, intuitively are kind of drawn to it. It kind of pulls you through the space. And it's a technique in a way by the shape of the form that you can kind of manipulate and control kind of the behavior of the people using the space. And so within my own house, this is our primary bathroom, master bathroom. I try to take this same approach to the forms in the space and manipulate and control the forms in the way they're arranged to kind of create this energy, the same way that this viaduct is doing, where it's trying to create these thresholds, trying to create these focal points to try to increase or make the space function as well as also just the experience of more efficiently.
Matt,
yeah.
Did you draw that out first, or did you just do that intuitively?
Another plant. Great. Perfect. So this room, when we finished the house and we moved into the house, this room wasn't completed. We only had one operating bathroom in the house, but we were, you know, anxious to get in. And so this room sat unfinished for a number of years until the point where my wife finally said, "Look, we got to get the bathroom done." And so then I set out to do that. But one of the things that I did here is I drew on the walls, I drew a line, this kind of like Gaudi-esque line through the room. And that was going to be the division between the tile, kind of like Gaudi's mosaic tile here on the wall, and the plaster above it. And so, and then in cases like the vanity here, it provided kind of like a backsplash along the wall here, but then it kind of morphed into other, like in the shower, it came up a little bit higher to create a tiled shower in the shower. So you'll see that in the house when we get out there. But this idea of this line that was drawn on the wall, if you recall back from last week, that the studio that I had with Fontuzzi, where we went actually into a building and we did our kind of like design in the building, in the space on the building. This was the same way. I didn't have a drawing in ahead of time of where this line would be on some kind of an elevational drawing. I drew it actually in the room on the wall, and it's a shorthand at the time since it was unfinished and we were living there. It's much easier than drawing it up. But the tile setters that were coming in, it was this way of kind of scribing on it, much like Gaudi, to where you're dealing with the architecture directly. You're not dealing with it through a drawing or through a model. You're dealing with it directly with its physical, tangible essence. And so when it comes over, actually it's kind of out of, but you can see it right here. So there's a window over here. The line comes out and dips down below it. And there's this kind of break point underneath the window that in a drawing might not accurately be depicted, but in the space, I can like, you know, get it exactly right. And also just the motion of the body. Like when you're drawing it like an artist on the wall, you can then, that movement, the gesture is directly tangibly related to your arm, your body, proportionately, all of that, as opposed to doing it on a scaled drawing on a piece of paper. And so this kind of gesture and flow just naturally kind of worked it out. You know, I had multiple lines until I got it to where the profile just felt right. And it's this intuitive working, again, that goes back to this idea of not so much putting it on the wall, looking at it and seeing if it looks right, but it just feels right as you're kind of like actually scribing it with the hand and the arm on the space. And so a lot of my practice, I try to bring, hold on to that kind of intuitive working. And not have that lost through just physically through the process of the method that I'm using.
But the actual tile work, is that somebody just did that on their own?
So once I got the line in place, this first set here, which is just a small little square mosaic, about a 1-inch square, I laid that after I got my line. I laid that across there, and then my tile workers that were coming in and doing the mosaic work, they had a place, like this was their border that they came to. And so it kind of like contained them from kind of, you know, going beyond.
You say that's a vanity?
Yes, this here. It's a little distorted because it's a fisheye photograph, but the vanity itself is kind of like oblong.
So can I clarify? So the yellow is a sink.
Yes.
On the right, and it's a deep sink, and then there's the spigot that comes up on the right.
Yeah, here's the faucet here. Here's the vanity sink.
Did you tell them just place the tiles, or did you place the tiles and they did?
So, and this could be a whole lecture in and of itself, but and we can get out there when we get to the house, but one of the ideas, back to today's lecture, when I come into a room, in this particular case, this bathroom, I'm top of my list. The first thing I'm thinking about, and even before I get to the room, I'm thinking, okay, what kind of feeling do I want to have when I come into this bathroom? When I come in to use this bathroom, you know, every day, at the start of the day, at the end of the day, you know, for me, and again, this is why it goes back to us. I see architecture at the essence. It's this emotive aspect. You want to pay attention to those feelings. You know, what kind of feeling do I have in this space when I'm sitting in on a lecture? And so I want this space in our bathroom to have a certain feel. And one of the feelings that I kind of landed on was this grotto over in Italy, in Capri. And it's this grotto that's down on the sea level of the Mediterranean. And you can kind of take this small little rowboat into the grotto, and you get inside, and you're still floating on the water, but then you have this stone grotto over top of you that creates this space. And the water and the sunlight from outside comes down through the water and kind of reflects through the water to where when you're inside the water, all is kind of glowing. So it's kind of a magical space. So I try to, as best I could, recreate the grotto in the bathroom. And so I told the tile setters, gave them all kinds of liberty, which I like to do with the various artisans that I work with on my architecture, is, you know, find very talented people, the most talented people I can find, creative people, and, you know, give them kind of like a broad stroke this is the end goal we're trying to hit, but then give them the liberty to kind of like do their thing and bring to that, you know, kind of their talents as well. And so I explained this kind of grotto thing, and actually one of the women that was laying this tile said, oh, you know, this window over here, which is one of the larger windows in the room, is the perfect kind of inlet to this grotto. So she, you know, which brings the light in, as you actually in the photograph, you can see it's pretty well lit. And so then the light as it comes in kind of reflects across the water. This is like the hot spot of the tile on the ground, kind of catching that water. And then as it kind of goes off, it becomes bluer, darker shades. And so she arranged the tiles themselves kind of in that general idea, but then she also brought a few other things with it. Really the only limit I put on them was drawing the line, say no tile above the line, and this is the kind of the feel that I'm trying to create, and then they tried to replicate that.
Where do you come into this
room? From right where you're standing right now, this is kind of the entry point. This is like what you would see as you're entering into the room. Sure.
Pat, question?
Yes.
I'm looking at, and you might not know because you're so used to it now, so maybe take a guess to when you were first going into space.
Yeah.
Do you, and you spoke about moving so much according to feeling.
Right.
Do you feel different in this space than you would if the bathroom was a square, standard bathroom?
Absolutely, yeah.
Can you describe it at all?
The difference? Yeah, so there's... That's part of, and we're going to get into this in 2 weeks. Part of what I use the house for is it's this laboratory where I'm studying this stuff. So, you know, prior to this house, I had not lived in circular space before over long periods of time. And so I wanted to see what impact does that have, if it has any impact at all. And so, you know, over time living in circular space, I've come to realize, you know, there's certain things. As an example, one tangible thing is acoustics is improved significantly because, you know, just the nature of the space, it kind of draws acoustically, it draws everything to a certain kind of sweet spot. Also, heating and cooling, the air circulates much easier than in a square space that has corners where, like, you get these cold spots, for example, where the air doesn't kind of reach because it's not being pulled back into these recesses. But the recesses are interesting in another way. So, you know, from a functional standpoint, there's those types of things. But then also, you know, in a little bit what we'll get into next week, from a psychological standpoint, the circular space can have an impact as well because it ties into, I think, this stuff that is earlier in our evolving as a civilization. Because if you go around the world, the earliest forms of architecture you'll find, almost all of them are circular in nature. And today, when things are built, almost all of them are boxes. And so there's been this shift from circular space to box shape. And, you know, what's the impact of that? And you know, not to take too much time, next week we'll definitely get into more of that.
Can I ask you, did you ever hear the expression, the devil hides in corners?
Yes. That's where the kids are sent to when they're bad.
I think the early architecture in some religious sects said no corners.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, there's all kinds of like layered reasons, and we'll dive into that much more next week for sure. So another early memory as a child, this is in Ohio, in the Hocking Hills, this place called Ash Cave. And this has, you'll notice, this has the same gesture that Gaudi's viaduct has. I mean, you have this kind of like, in the wave, the gymnast, it's like, you know, the ground is kind of sweeping up, it's coming up with this, it's rolling over, and then, you know, the leg is extending down through the waterfall to this point here. And so it has this, the space, even though this is not Gaudi's viaduct, and this is not a wave, and this is not a gymnast, all four of these are creating the same gesture in the space through different means, different forms. And so this is kind of the way that I kind of approach architectural space is when I'm looking to see what's the feel of this space, you know, and how, and so the feel of this space as you come in is going to be very similar if you were a surfer on a surfboard kind of riding through that tunnel of the wave, or whether you're walking down through Gaudi's viaduct. it's going to have a similar feel to the way space feels. It's going to be a different experience for sure, because it's a different environment that you're seeing, the stuff that you're taking in. But the physical form is creating a sensation, and this is what we got into last week with the proximics. It's creating a physical or an emotional response to that physical form through just the gesture of the form, the way it's presented. So with that, this feeling of this space, it gets, as you experience it, in this case, as a child, when we'd come to this place as kind of like a trip, these experiences would get locked into your subconscious, you know, much like the first day of preschool for me. And so as they're getting kind of locked and recorded into my subconscious, that recording is also impacting me when I go from place to place. When I go to Gowdy's viaduct for the first time and I walk through that space, I say, oh wow, this feels a lot like Ash Cave when we were kids. That's this feeling that my subconscious is holding on to. And then even more significantly, over time, your subconscious kind of takes those same kind of themes or feelings. You find that there's certain ones that kind of continue to reoccur in your life. And those ones that continue to reoccur, I pay attention to, because I find that there's a significance there. There's some reason that it keeps coming back up into my mind. So I wanted to kind of go through a few examples of some of those just to illustrate this point. This is Richard Serra's piece entitled Torqued Ellipse. And this is from back in 1998. I saw his work in Los Angeles at the Museum of Contemporary Art. And he would take these steel forms that are 2 inches thick, and you can see kind of the scale of the figure here. And he would, in this particular piece, he had one inside the other, and so he had a split, you know, an opening, a slot that you would enter in, and then you could wind through and find the slot on the opposite side and then arrive at this interior space. And so much like, you know, Jeffrey's mansion, he's creating this experience that you have as you enter into the space, kind of like fold through it, you know, around the corner, you don't see what's there, and it kind of like creates, again, this sense of curiosity, wonder, interest the nature of the fact that it's turning the corner and you can't see the end. And then you find yourself eventually getting to the interior in this space that now you feel, because of the scale of it, you feel completely enclosed, much architecturally, kind of like this secured condition. A few years later, in 2006, he created this series, which he refers to as the Torqued Torus Inversion. And he took these same forms, but in this case, in addition to curving them in plan, he curved them in section. He put a slight bellow kind of curvature into them. And this was significant. Again, architecture often happens or acts in very subtle ways or very slight detail shifts. And so in this case, this form here has a convexity from the interior to where the form is truncated and does this. And so when you're experiencing the space, because the top is falling away from you ever so slightly, it releases the space, that image that we saw before when you were inside and you felt completely secure and enclosed. Here it kind of releases at the top, and you no longer have this like feeling of kind of like enclosure that you have with the other one.
Where is that?
So this one, this photograph right here, I can't tell by the ceiling, but This circulates in different places. I saw this one was at MoMA in New York City when I saw it myself. This is not MoMA here, but it's also, I believe he's got some of these in Bilbao at the Guggenheim.
Is his work in Bilbao?
Absolutely. In fact, actually a large part of Bilbao was made specifically for his work as a permanent collection.
Yes, so was that space.
Very good. So this.
Well,
fact, when they did the renovations of MoMA in New York, they did it specifically to handle the weight of his pieces. And that's actually the one I saw, which was in 2006 when MoMA's edition opened up. They were doing a retrospective of Sarah's work, and they had a whole bunch of his stuff brought in. So this slight bellowing dissolves away this sense of enclosure that you had, the security that you had in the previous piece is now kind of like deformed or dissolved away, much like with Gary's chairs and Gaudi's chairs. It's this kind of softening that he's creating in not so much the physical form, but it's in the experience of the form. Like, so he's playing with this same nature of how the form makes you feel, and the fact that it's now no longer feels enclosed and it's feeling kind of released. And so that's really what is interesting or intrigues Sarah in his work. This is a scale model here, which we'll see next week, of my house. And these forms that I was creating on the house themselves were kind of drawn from different elements that I was finding. Just much like the gymnast or the wave, I was looking at this particular figure, the weight, this trunk-heavy, top-heavy way that this piece of sculpture is kind of created, and the way that this weight is carried, and just the angle and the gesture, much like we were looking at kind of the wave. This has also a different type of gesture, different than Gaudi's viaduct. But this kind of gesture I was trying to create in the house itself in a similar way. Just to also illustrate this point, in 1989, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was an article that was run in 91 that I read in National Geographic here on the right-hand side, talking about the wall when it came down, and the fact that these Berliners had lived in with this wall for a number of years, and that once the wall was taken down, the wall still kind of remained in their minds, emotionally and just intellectually. And so, again, this was directly dealing with these ideas that I was thinking of, is how does this wall still impact you even after the wall is gone? And so I was looking in this this undergraduate project that I was working on in Eisenman's studio, to where we were tasked with, this was a design competition that he entered in Berlin at the location of where the wall once stood. So I had this idea of trying to create this reference to where the wall used to be in the structure itself. And so the structure kind of steps over the wall that was once there, was essentially the idea behind it. But in my mind, it was this gesture, much like this figure drawing that I was doing in an art class at the time, to where I was looking at the form, much like the gymnast, or Nefertiti's head, looking at the form as to how, what kind of gesture this is creating physically, and the fact that the leg, the head is placed on the knee, carrying the load of the head down straight vertically as opposed to Gaudi's inclined column, and then carrying and received down here by the hands and engaging with the ground, this kind of grounding. But significantly, the leg is kind of folded over. And so it's this folding of these forms, similar here to the architectural structure, kind of having this fold over top of this pre-existing Berlin Wall, or in this case, taking it even further, looking at the way that this particular form is positioned, to where it's taking these gestures and these forms, folding them to create this complex physical structure. And so these were some of the models that we'll get into next week, but some of these studies that I would do is studying the gesture of the form, much the same way like a sculptor would study a form, in trying to identify what form am I trying to create for the house itself. And so most recently, I found, interestingly enough, this was back in the 1991, this project here on the left. About 10 years later, when I was working on the design of the house, I was doing these gesture studies here. And then 20 years later, most recently, this past year, I've been doing these studies in clay right now, and so I'm taking, trying to take these, the clay, and I'm trying to fold the clay in such a way that I can, again, study these gestures that are created. And so here in this case, the clay is folded much the same way a knee would be folded on a leg, and trying to recreate these gestures in the form itself. And so with that, in the last few minutes that we have here, I'm going to describe kind of the way that I approach this design process in a very subconscious way, as opposed to last week with a very conscious way that Rowena would with proximics. As I mentioned at the head of this lecture, that creativity is drawing from the subconscious realm. It's down below. It's in these processes that are happening with the body, the way your body takes in these senses unconsciously, and it's dealing with these and creating these intuitions and these instincts that you have, that you might become consciously aware of at a certain point, but all of those processes are happening below the radar, and that's also the same place that this creative interaction is playing around with these elements subconsciously. And so trying to understand that, trying to develop that, trying to refine that process and make it more efficient, more useful in the work that you're creating is a difficult thing, because you're dealing with these things that you can't directly tap and touch or describe in words. So something I wrote recently to kind of describe this, when I become suspicious is when there's a sense of familiarity. Again, I'm focusing on this when I feel a particular sense of familiarity. And this familiarity is responding, again, to something that I'm playing with that creates something that I recognize as familiar. And so when I recognize these things, I become aware of it. I play along. I don't ask too many questions because I know I'm dealing with it subconsciously. If I ask too many questions, it becomes conscious. And so I pursue it in a very kind of hands-off way. But what I'm looking for when I'm doing that are these synchronicities. I'm looking for places where these things kind of like synchronize and come together and make sense together. And those are the types of things that, again, working with almost intuitively is the way to refine these things that I'm working on. And so much like we saw in these images here of the folding leg, over time, these are some of these, this the way that gesture folds is the kind of these synchronicities that I find that I'm working and trying to work through subconsciously. And then finally, as you refine these, you get to a point where it starts to crystallize and it starts to make sense, or it reaches a point where it seems like it's final, or it has been solidified. And so it's this kind of like transcendent moment to where you realize that it's been resolved. These things that continue to resurface subconsciously to you, it's because it's these unfinished, unresolved elements. And by finally reaching a point where you can kind of put it to bed, is this idea that it's been resolved and worked out. And then you'll find actually once you do that, it doesn't continue to resurface. These other types of gestures might start to surface as well and kind of like play at the back of your mind. And so one of the last point here in the closing minutes, one of the techniques that I use tangibly to do this is what I refer to as memory sketches. And this goes back to the first half of this lecture. These memories that I've been describing. One of the tasks that I'll do with my own clients is that when I first meet with them in these initial meetings, there are these people that I have not, I don't often know prior to this meeting. So there are these strangers to me. So in a way to kind of get to know them as quickly as possible, I'll task them with these memory sketches that I'll do. And I'll say, okay, assignment for our next meeting. I want you to go home and I want you to draw a sketch of the house that you grew up in as a child. And then bring that back and then we'll take a look at it. From that sketch, I can very quickly get to know these people than if I spent, three or four meetings just talking to them and asking them about their childhood or asking them these other things. And what's great about a sketch too is that if I ask them about their childhood, what was meaningful, that kind of thing, what people tell you is very different than maybe what actually was meaningful to them. Whereas in a sketch, it doesn't lie as much because they might not be, most people are not as sophisticated where they can put lies into a sketch. At that point, they kind of reach the realm of an artist. These sketches, I can look and I can see, you know, the things that are in the sketch are clearly significant because they remembered or put them in from their memory of their drawing of this childhood home. The things that are absent are clearly insignificant to them because they didn't think to remember to put them in. And then in some cases, if you're lucky, you can still access their childhood home and you can take the sketches to that childhood home and you can compare them. And so then I can immediately see, oh, wow, what happens to this window? It's like, you know, and so you can make those connections as far as significant and insignificant. And so then those significances is what gives it a subjective quality to that individual person that I'm working for. And so I can make their home that I'm working on now, I can try to bring those significant things in so that way their house has more meaning to them as an individual, drawing from these things that go all the way back to their childhood. And so to end on that, with our own house here, this is a drawing that was done by a kindergartner that came through our house when my two sons were young kindergartners. We had field day or field trips where we'd bring the classes through our house. And I had this, I do these memory sketches on the kids because I was trying to learn from these kids. And so I'd have the teacher do, before they come to our house, the day before, the teacher would ask the students to draw a picture of a house. And that was the only kind of instruction she would give. So they would draw pictures of the house. And when you ask a kid to draw a picture of a house, they tend to draw their own house because that's the house they know. And then the second day, they came on a field trip to our house and then we came through the house and they were all excited to see it. The third day back in school, I had the teachers give them the same prompt. I said, draw a picture of a house, and then they draw a second picture. And so then from that, here's my oldest son, his kindergartner class. And then a few years later, my youngest son, as you can tell, always wanted to be right out in front and center. But then, much like Rowena's pairing, we take the house on the left here is the drawing they drew before they came a visit through our house. Right side is the same student's drawing after they came through our house. So as an example, you can see here, their house is floating off the ground. Which is interesting, to where, and also it has, you know, all the elements. It's got the doors, the windows, fence kind of enclosing the backyard. But the fact that the house is kind of like floating, suspended, then you come after coming through our house the following day, here the house is actually now grounded back into the ground. In addition, it's taken on more color, kind of like a rainbow of color. Another student here, you can see the house on the left-hand side, and it's completely transformed into a whole new shape on the right-hand side. And so you can see the impact that my house is having on these children, making this child, as an example, realize that a house doesn't necessarily have to be this type of a house. This is also not something, as they're coming through the house, that we're saying to them directly and concretely. This is something that they're just inferring by the experience of coming through the house. So again, it's happening on this subconscious level. And then finally, a third one here, much similar to the last one. This one I like in particular because you can see the garage with the car, the drive, the house, the garden. It's got literally every kind of stereotypical element that you would find in a children's drawing of a house. It's even got the smoke coming out of the chimney, clouds and sun in the sky. Then, you know, the next house, it kind of, all these things, like the garage is gone, the garden is gone, and it's kind of reducing down to the essence of really what really matters in a house, to where, you know, the garage is not that important. In addition to that, you know, the shape and the form, you know, the circular form and then kind of like the heart shape coming up on top. Again, you can see just in a drawing, you can very quickly see the impact that this child had even without talking to them specifically directly about it. So next week we'll pick up with the design. Next week we'll get into more tangibly the plans, drawings, and models that I use to actually work through the design of the house.
Thank you.
Thank you.